A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm John Prideaux, the US editor at The Economist, and you're listening to The Economist Asks. This week, we're asking about power, satire, and laughter.
I said to everyone at the start, look, this is a comedy, but we have to be respectful of the fact of what happened to millions of people. So the comedy isn't about, you know, isn't it funny that, you know, millions of people were sent to the gulags? It's more the comedy of paranoia, the comedy that takes place within the confines of the Kremlin.
Our guest today is Armando Iannucci, creator of hit comedy shows such as The Thick of It and Veep. Armando's turned to history for the setting of his latest film, The Death of Stalin, which explores the intrigue at the top of the Politburo that followed Stalin's death in 1953. The movie is getting great reviews. Armando, thanks for being here. You must have a lot of projects come across your desk the whole time. You've had, you know, great successes recently. What was it about this graphic novel by Fabien Nery and Thierry Robin that appealed to you? And was the kind of comedy potential in it immediately obvious?
Oh, very obvious. I mean, I had been thinking about doing something about dictators, really. Contemporary fiction. Imagining, say, Britain had a dictator, how would we get to that situation and what would that be like? So I'd been reading about the whole, you know, autocrats and the Cultural Revolution and this double think and all, everything. And simultaneously with that, I was approached with the graphic novel, and it was a French production company, Quad, who owned the film rights to it. They sent it to me and said, we're going to make this movie. We'd like you to direct it. We think you should direct it. And I said, well, I'm a bit busy doing Veep. And they said, we'll wait. And that's what happened. But honestly, I read it and instantly I thought, well, this is the story. Why invent something when this is what happened? This combination of terror trying to control the minds of an entire population. And yes, the absurdity of it. I mean, the way into the graphic novel, and which is the way into the film, was what grabbed me. It's a true story. It's a concert. Famous Russian pianist Maria Udina is playing a Mozart piano concerto. It's going out live on Radio Moscow. Stalin rings up and says, I'd like a recording of this. I'm enjoying it. They put the phone down. They realize there's no recording. They weren't recording it. It's going out live. The head of Radio Moscow, played in the film by Paddy Considine, runs out into the auditorium as the audience are leaving, saying, lock the doors. Everyone, come back in now. Just orders them to come back in. Tells the orchestra, we're going to do it again for Stalin. At which point the conductor faints and knocks himself unconscious. So now they have no conductor. So then they have to scour Moscow to try and find a replacement conductor who comes in and does it in his pajamas and dressing gown. That's all a true story. That's all absolutely true, except in reality, they got through three conductors because the conductor number two came in but was drunk. So they had to go out and get a third conductor in. But I thought if we put three conductors in, people wouldn't believe it. But it's that level of paranoia that leads people to do crazy things. Going into the movie, The Death of Stalin, I said to everyone at the start, look, this is a comedy, but we have to be respectful of the fact of what happened to millions of people. So the comedy isn't about, you know, isn't it funny that, you know, millions of people were sent to the gulags? It's more, as you say, the comedy of paranoia, the comedy that takes place within the confines of the Kremlin and the inner committee meetings, the Politburo or the Presidium, as it was known then, trying to work out what the hell to do now that the great leader was no more. You know, I was taken out of my comfort zone doing it deliberately in that I knew I was going to be directing scenes that were not meant to be funny, that were meant to be dramatic. And it was up to me to make those scenes as, you know, memorable as the comic set pieces. But also, in a way, I kind of want the audience to be taken out of their comfort zone. Yes, you're at a comedy, you're laughing, but there will be moments where you're not meant to laugh and it will, you know, it will suddenly stop you up short.
It's also a different kind of laughing. I mean, yes. I had to, I'm a, you know, unabashed fan of your work. I had to stop myself from watching Veep on airplanes because I, when I laugh spontaneously, I tend to kind of snort through my nose in a way that other passengers started to find disconcerting. So I should stop. Death of Stalin is a different kind of laugh.
It is. It's a nervous, you know, it's a release, you know, and which goes back to the research we found at the time was they circulated joke books about Stalin. They wanted to make jokes. And if you were found with a copy, you could be shot. If you were heard telling one of these jokes, you could be shot. And yet somehow comedy was a way of saying, look, you might have told me what to say. You might have told me where I can go. You might have stopped my work for this reason, but you haven't got my mind. The fact that I can make fun of you shows that I'm still, there's something still alive in my head that you haven't managed to control. And also, I wanted the audience to get that sense of uncertainty as they go through it, that, you know, not knowing from minute to minute who the next one to go might be, you know, that level of sort of unease.
The reaction to the movie in Russia is going to be interesting because you have an aging dictator. You also have a lot of people who laugh at Putin. And also, I read in a newspaper article that there was a pro-Kremlin newspaper who described the movie as a nasty send-up by outsiders who know nothing of our history and as a planned provocation. So, I mean, that seems like sort of A, brilliant PR for the movie, but B, you know, it arrives in Russia at a very interesting time.
Very interesting time. And, you know, and that quote was from someone who hasn't seen the film. And the Russian press I've spoken to already said they've enjoyed it. They said, thank God you didn't use fake Russian accents. We hate that. But yes, I mean, it's an interesting time. You know, in Moscow at the moment, there are statues going up. There's a Stalin bust going up, but there's also a statue of Tsar Nicholas II. The message is very much, you know, the strong leader, the strong man, the, you know, the one person who can save the entire country. That's the kind of the implication. You speak to people, because we went out to Moscow and researched the film, and, you know, I spoke to especially younger people there. You say, what are you taught about Stalin at school? And they say, we're taught, some people say he killed millions, other people say he industrialized us and turned us into a superpower. You decide. It's that sort of level of, we'll leave this an open question. We'll leave it for you to answer.
Can we make an abrupt right turn? My day job is US politics, US editor here. So I have lots of questions to ask you about Donald Trump.
And yes, I don't think it's that abrupt a right turn.
Well, that's a whole other series. I'm not sure I necessarily want to go down that.
Talking of delusional narcissists who terrify their entire country. Yeah, let's go on.
There's a school of thought that says that Trump has killed satire in America because although he's been great for newspapers, he's been great for a lot of the nightly shows, the thing that seems funny about Donald Trump is Trump himself. It's the clips himself.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, a character who's a thinly disguised version of him. Do you buy that? Do you think kind of Trump is bad for satire on some level?
No, as you say, and I've said this before, he is his own satirist. Every tweet he makes has its own exaggeration and distortion, which is what satirists do and comedians do. Any attempt to replicate Trump in a fictional form, I think, is going to suffer because it will never be as true and as horrific as the reality. I think, though, that comedy, political comedy in America, has got stronger from another means, which is journalism. John Oliver on his Last Week Tonight and Seth Meyers and, you know, the chat show host that you said, Stephen Colbert, Samantha Bee, The Daily Show. What they do is they employ teams of researchers and journalists and they investigate what's going on. If Trump is saying that everything is fake news, that you lot behind your microphones and your cameras are all fake, into that artificial vacuum, comedians are now pouring in with their fact-checking. And so someone like John Oliver would say, OK, Trump said this, but 4 years ago he said that, which is the opposite. Two months ago, Trump said he was going to do this. Well, this is what's happened, which is the opposite. And he lays out the facts and the comedy comes from the funny sequence of truths that he puts out in front of you. So it's an interesting time. I think what it is there was a period where comedians had to kind of take stock and think, okay, this isn't working. You know, just doing funny Trump impressions, you know, isn't really going to get to the bottom of what the hell is going on at the moment. So, and I think now you're getting a whole range, a generation of comedians who have very strong effect on analysing and deconstructing Trump now.
Another thing that interests me about Trump and humour is that he uses it a lot, right? He
yeah.
uses a kind of humour that
yeah.
wouldn't make it into one of your scripts. It's not something I necessarily find funny myself, but he really understands the kind of political power of humour, that if you
yeah.
can get somebody to laugh
yeah.
at one of his political opponents, he's
yeah.
basically won and he's, you know, he's
yeah.
destroyed them. You saw this a lot in the Republican primary.
Yeah.
He liked to come up with these little epithets
yes.
for people. So, you know, Marco Rubio was Little Marco.
Little Marco.
And he knows
Lying Ted Cruz.
Lying
Crooked
Ted
Hillary.
Cruz, Crooked Hillary.
And now it's Rocket Man.
Right, now Rocket Man.
And Little Rocket Man.
And he knows that once you've laughed at the opponent,
yeah.
he's kind of got you.
Yeah.
I mean, that sort of would make him harder to satirize as well.
No, I mean, it's true. I mean, I did an interview in the Big Issue this week with John Oliver, and he was saying he is kind of funny in a very basic way, but he understands the rhythms of jokes and comedy, and he utilizes them. I mean, you mustn't forget what he's... And he's not an idiot, you know. He's deluded, and he's erratic and dangerous, but he's not an idiot. He's smart, but smart at certain things. He's a smart salesperson. That's his whole entire career. He's selling himself as going to be terrific. You know, he's going to do a deal with America that would be better than any other deal. You know, it's all talk, but you're kind of lured into it. You're slightly dazzled and charmed by it, you know. And part of that is the humor, it's not self-deprecation, it's against his opponents, but it employs a comedian's method of undercutting someone and deflating someone, a figure in authority. And that puts him in the eyes of the public as the David attacking the Goliath, strangely enough, you know. So that's where he's coming from. There are also, though, dangerous undercurrents, you know, parallels. I'm not saying he's like Stalin, but Stalin killed opposition by calling anyone who disagreed with him an enemy of the people, you know, turned them into opposition, became criminal. And what Trump does is that, you know, he's shut down the opposition by shaming them, by calling them fake news, or by saying they're being unpatriotic. It's that similar tendency to take the counter-argument and just regard it as a weapon hurled at you and therefore must be stopped. And that's a dangerous tendency I find in him.
One of the things that's hard about covering him as a reporter is that sometimes when he comes out with these things, you know, attacks a particular media
yeah.
organization, I think it was NBC last week, there's something almost a bit kind of playful about it.
Yeah.
And you can't quite, you know, calibrate your interpretation to work out if it's kind of genuinely sinister.
I know.
Whether there really is a parallel with something,
yeah.
you know, a bit 1930s, or if it's him sort of playing with his audience a little bit.
It's a little bit, yes. I've often thought that. In fact, the people he attacks most are the ones he's most obsessed with and actually has a kind of an admiration. I mean, he talks about the failing New York Times. He reads the New York Times every day. You know, he gives lots of... I think he's probably given more interviews to the New York Times than to any other publication. Failing MSNBC, which he watches every day. You know, you know, Crooked Hillary, who, you know, he and the Clintons go way back, and there are interviews you can dig out of him endorsing the Clintons and saying what a wonderful woman Hillary Clinton is and what a great politician, you know. So it's a strange, it's almost like he does this but would turn privately to the target and say it's just business, you know. I don't mean that, I've got to say this, you know. The people love it, you know. That's the kind of, but that's why he's kind of dangerous, because he's using language as just a tactic. He's using these threats as a tactic. They don't mean anything other than the immediate effect that they're designed to produce. That's all they're there for, you know. And it's kind of working. I do suspect, though, that people are eventually going to get tired of it. You know, how many times can he say he's the greatest president ever? You know, when things aren't happening, it will start to kind of sound a bit thin, really. It's my only hope.
There's a, not so much the death of Stalin, but in some of your earlier work, there is, you know, a view of politics and power that is, I wouldn't quite say kind of cynical, but the comedy often comes from the fact that people are kind of out there, and, you know, out for themselves, you know, incredibly vain, narcissistic, and so forth. How accurately does that reflect your view of politics?
I mean, I love politics, and you write. Initially, when you start as a writer, you write about what it is you like and which you know about. And, you know, I was a political geek, and you know, the drama of politics as well. I grew up in Hillhead, where the famous Hillhead by-election, Roy Jenkins trying to become leader of the SDP by winning the Hillhead seat in Glasgow. Suddenly, you know, every major politician of every major party was like on the street. You'd turn the corner and there would be Tony Benn, and you'd go to a speaker's meeting, there would be Edward Heath talking about, you know, and Shirley Williams would be out campaigning. And it was great. I loved it. I want people to take part in the political process, which is why I spent the last election trying to urge young voters to register and to vote. I don't want politics to fall apart. I don't want people to be disenchanted with it. My fear, though, and a lot of what's gone into the thick of it, my fear is that politicians have been taking too many people for granted. Blair and Cameron were focusing on the marginals in the middle England, you know, the 100,000 voters who could swing it for them. So everything was directed at them on the understanding that everyone else would vote for them anyway. And what you then, not surprisingly, saw was the number of people taking part in elections dropping. You know, it used to be up at like 80-85% in the 50s. And the two main parties between them used to get, what, about 90% of the vote? It was starting to drop. So the last Blair government, I think, was something like elected on the basis of, was it 34-35% of the vote and a low turnout, and yet had a majority. And that's why people feel disenchanted. So what I was trying to show in those programs were politicians getting more and more narrowly focused on fewer and fewer people and being paranoid that their message to those people was being disrupted or that they'd said the wrong thing, you know, whereas these vast swathes of the electorate who weren't being spoken to. And what we've seen in the last 7 years or so are these, you know, forgotten masses in the electorate turning somewhere else. So you're getting UKIP or you're getting, you know, the Corbyn view of what Labour is as opposed to the Blairite view of what Labour is. And you're seeing it in America, you know, not people not only turning to Donald Trump, but turning to Bernie Sanders. You know, it's like, give us something different then, because the same old people have been saying the same old things, but to fewer and fewer of us. And that's the frustration. And, you know, and it does worry me if it's not corrected, there will be violence and anger spilling out.
Yeah, which won't be very funny.
No.
I was a political reporter in Washington when Veep started. Sure you know this because people have said it to you already, but no, Veep had a cult following early on among political reporters because a lot of the stuff that we came across, you know, resembled plot lines in Veep. And I know there was a certain amount of kind of cross-fertilization there. The one thing that I suppose it didn't quite ring true to me was that, you know, some of the politicians I come across are genuinely idealistic people.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
And I wonder if that's a hard thing for comedy to take on because it's not that funny.
It's not, and it's boring to watch, you know. A half-hour comedy about a minister sitting down and going through her kind of briefing papers and making some decisions would be, you know, a fascinating documentary, I'm sure. But, yeah, there's no story there. So, of course, yes. And I kind of argue that actually the ones that the audience sympathise with most are the elected politicians. You know, in the thick of it, it was Nicola Murray that you kind of felt she had an agenda. Her agenda was social mobility. And it's being hampered by everything else around her. It's being hampered by the media, by the number 10, the lack of money, the advisors giving her the wrong advice, the unfortunate accident in front of a poster or whatever. And similarly in Veep, you know, Selina Meyer, she did start with some things that she wanted to do. You know, she wanted to do Senate vote reform and environmental issues, green jobs and all this sort of thing. And I think what we're trying to show is just to survive in that world, unfortunately, principles start being compromised and decisions get made, which is, I'd love to back that, but I can't because I'll be sacked, so I won't back it. But, you know, one day when I'm in power, I will back it. You know, that kind of putting stuff off for later when you're in charge kind of thing. And I just want to show that, you know, that's how people who start off doing one thing can end up doing another. But I'm not saying all politicians are evil and nasty. Nobody commits a crime. In none of the shows, nobody commits a crime. What they do is have to deal with kind of minor crisis on a daily basis. But, you know, I have an admiration for people who go into politics because they want to change things, they want to make a difference. And it's a sort of a warning as to what is it that we are doing to them that is stopping them from that. You know, we expect politicians to have the perfect answer whenever a microphone is shoved in front of their face. We expect them to be on duty 24 hours a day. We don't like it when they go on holiday. You know, we don't like it if they go to the opera. You know, I lay a lot of the blame on us. You know, it's not just the media. It's us. Our expectations are that they have to be perfect from the word go. And nobody is perfect, and we should allow for that.
Armando Iannucci, thank you very much. Go and see The Death of Stalin. It's terrific. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Pleasure.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.